Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. After floods ravaged central and southern West Virginia 2 weeks ago, some residents are wondering, how can we rebuild? And can communities bounce back after a devastating disaster? Should we know better?
They literally had dozens and dozens of recommendations, such as better regulating timbering or better regulating strip mining, to things like having better standards for stream crossings and culverts.
We'll see what lessons we can learn by revisiting the town of Mullins, West Virginia, which was hit by a flood in 2001.
Right after the flood, I was extremely concerned because literally every business in town was shut down, was out of commission. Many of the business owners were trying to make a determination whether they were going to come back here in Mullins or come back at all anywhere. And a group of us, businessmen, got together and made a determination that we would make a go of it.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The beauty of these hills can provide the perfect backdrop for majestic photographs and even inspire writers to pen their next masterpiece. But the topography can also create challenges.
I just really think that the right storm at the right time could impact almost anywhere. I mean, I can't think of one place that I would say, oh, no, you're okay there. We are all susceptible to that because it comes with the territory, if you will.
That's Jessica Moore, a senior geologist with the West Virginia Geological and Economic Survey. She also said that the type of flash flooding that hit West Virginia on June 23rd is dangerous because of the way it flooded small streams so quickly, really overpowering everything and everybody. On today's show, we're going to talk more about what life after a flood looks like and what it takes to recover. On Thursday, June 23rd, severe weather swept across 44 counties in West Virginia. 12 of those counties were hit with historic flooding. On our episode last week, we heard Appalachian stories of tragedy, resilience, and hope. This week, we'll dig a little deeper into the question, what does it take to rebuild? People across West Virginia right now are searching for hope. Hope they can physically rebuild what they've lost, but also find the emotional resilience to go on. Through it all, some say their faith is keeping them strong. Here's what one of the flood survivors, Carol Holmes in Richwood, told me the Friday after the flood.
You gotta have willpower. That's what you have to have. You gotta do it, and you do it.
That's how Carol plans to get through this. How long will it be before residents like her can expect to feel something close to normalcy again? Those who have been through a flood know it can take months, even years, to rebuild. And the pain of remembering what's been lost? Well, that doesn't ever go away for some people. And that'll especially be true for the families and friends who lost loved ones in the flood. Nearly 2 weeks after the June 23rd flooding in West Virginia, the phrase, West Virginia Strong, can be seen painted on buildings, cars, and windows. But Carol often reports that no matter how strong the community, studies have shown emotional healing from a natural disaster can be a long process.
Rachel Taylor stands on the front porch of her little yellow house in White Sulphur Springs. The front door is pasted with paw prints where her dog tried to get in during the flood. Across the street, nestled between two battered houses, is an empty lot with a memorial. The dog, he survived the flood and is now with family in Kentucky. Taylor's across the street neighbors, the Nicelys, did not.
When I start feeling overwhelmed with this, I just look across the street at that memorial and I think, there's nothing that we have lost that can't be replaced or mended.
Taylor gestures at her gutted living room. She and her husband spent 7 years renovating this 1930s Craftsman room by room. They were just about done with renovations when their home was flooded a few weeks ago.
You know, the first couple of days, it was very intense. It was kind of crisis mode. Maybe that's the way I would describe it, because you didn't really have time to think about it and process it.
Once the full extent of the damage set in, Taylor says she developed severe nausea and car sickness to the point of not being able to drive.
They're talking to different people. They said that's probably your nerves, you know, the stress level. You don't realize your body's just, you know, having a response to this in a way that's not normal for you.
Taylor has flood insurance that will allow her to rebuild, but she says her family will likely move out of the neighborhood once the home is restored or ready for sale.
I think the words we use when we talk about it are, I don't know if I have it in me, I'm not sure I can do this again, things like that. And then we just say, well, you know, we're going to take it one day at a time.
Experts say this kind of response is normal following natural disasters.
It's a physical aspect of stress response. You know, it will affect the body's ability to concentrate, to rest, and to be able to function. And that cognition is slowed.
Marcy Vaughn leads the state-funded West Virginia Crisis Response Team, Church Disaster Assistance Teams, and the organization Hope Animal Assisted Crisis Response also offered support and a meaningful presence to victims.
From the behavioral health perspective, we find that we're more in need after the 10th, 12th day, just because immediate needs of food, clothing, and shelter take precedence.
In the first few days following the flood, Vaughn said her team split their time between helping people replace lost psychiatric medications and looking for signs of mental distress in people at shelters or feeding stations.
We see fatigue, problems with cognition. You have individuals who walk into a supply center and they have no idea what they need.
A 2012 study published in the Journal of Social Psychiatry and Psychiatric Epidemiology found that while most people bounce back a few months after a disaster, if you don't prevent ongoing stressors, such as the lack of a home, financial challenges, and repeated exposure to the trauma, people will continue to struggle.
As the fatigue sets in and the frustration, we see an increased need for behavioral health intervention.
As for Vaughn, she says their real work will begin when national organizations and media have lost interest. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from the Benedum Foundation. So it's not easy to bounce back, but it can be done. And if the willpower is there, that's just the beginning. You may remember another major flood that hit southern West Virginia back in 2001. It was exactly 15 years ago on July 8th. Like the flooding this year, that one was also a flash flood that came too quickly for people to react, trapping some people in their cars and homes. One of the hardest hit communities in the 2001 flood was Mullins, West Virginia, my hometown. Some businesses in Mullins never came back. And back in 2005, in the midst of Hurricane Katrina, the people of New Orleans were asking the question many West Virginians are asking today: can we rebuild? What does it take? To see what the people of southern West Virginia had learned in the wake of the 2001 floods, NPR reporter Melissa Block visited Mullins to find out how recovery efforts were going 4 years after that flood. Let's take a listen now to that broadcast from 2005.
Flash floods tore through the hollows of southern West Virginia, destroyed hundreds of businesses and homes, and left communities wondering how they could ever recover. The floods came without warning. The forecast that day called for just a chance of showers. But early on a Sunday morning, July 8th, 2001, the rains came instead in a torrent.
The water literally was as if people were pouring it out of a boot.
11 inches of rain in 4 hours. Water poured down the mountains and quickly flooded the creeks and rivers that wind through the valleys. Houses and trailers were ripped from their foundations and swept away. They jammed up under bridges, so the water had nowhere to go, and that made the flooding even worse.
Me and my children was on our way to church, and I noticed on our way to church that the water seemed to be coming in the road out of the mountains and everything, and I said, this could be a bad day.
I knew it was something out of the ordinary because of the way it was raining and carrying on.
Rain and rain and rain. Next thing I know, the house was gone.
We had to hurry and get out, just barely with what we had on our backs. It come up so quick.
We was lucky that it happened at 10 o'clock in the morning instead of 10 o'clock at night. I mean, if it had been at night, I'm sure we'd have lost some lives.
But it receded just about as fast as it came up. It sure did.
Some who lost their homes moved in for a while with family on higher ground. FEMA came in and set up trailer parks. There was one death that morning, and it was in Wyoming County. The Guyandotte and Slab Fork Rivers meet in the town of Mullins, population about 1,700. Mullins, spelled with an E, was settled by A.P. Mullins, spelled with an I, in 1894. Signs around town explain simply, change in spelling by failure to dot I. This is coal country. The first commercial coal mine opened in Wyoming County in 1908. In its heyday, 6 passenger trains would stop in Mullins every day. None now. You will see coal trains, 100, 150 cars long, hauling coal steadily out of southern West Virginia. Production is booming, but with automation, coal jobs are disappearing. The county dropped from 8,000 coal jobs in the early 80s to just 3,000 jobs now. The county's lost about a third of its population in that time. So for towns like Mullins, that had taken a serious economic beating already, the violent flood of 2001 was a sucker punch. I wanted to know, what does it take for a town to come back? What holds it together after a disaster? And what's lost?
That was the water level.
Wow. Now, how tall are you?
I'm about 6'2".
And how tall is that?
So it's about 6.5 feet.
Wow.
Charlie Feller points to the high water mark, a spot way up on the door of C.V. Feller Insurance, the business his grandfather started in downtown Mullins in 1925.
Where we have such severe, steep mountains coming down into a narrow valley, when that amount of water, that 11 inches of rain in 4 hours, it just acts like a funnel, and it just pours it right down into the valley, gathering speed and strength as it goes. Here in the downtown section where my business is, it looked like a war zone with just windows all broken out. It was just hard to believe. It's hard to describe to people the devastation. And I can sympathize with the people in the Gulf Coast now suffering what they did, because we know that it just devastates everything.
When this flood happened back in 2001, what was your expectation of what would happen with this town?
Right after the flood, I was extremely concerned, because literally every business in town was shut down, was out of commission. Many of the business owners were trying to make a determination whether they were going to come back here in Mullins or come back at all anywhere. And a group of us, the businessmen, got together and made a determination that we would make a go of it. This was our home. This is where we had made our living for so long, and this is where our families were. So we just determined that we were going to come back and get back into business.
Downtown Mullins is partly back. 2 flower stores are open again.
Yeah, I'm going to put some roses in.
I may dress it up a little bit since it is her birthday.
Yeah.
Also, 2 barber shops, a tavern, doctor's office, a couple of restaurants, a dollar store. The businesses that did come back got a lot of help from the state and federal government, microloans and forgivable loans, but much has been lost. I drive around Mullins with the mayor, Harold Worley, past boarded-up buildings and vacant lots.
Yeah, and see, there was a theater building and things there. We tore all that down after the flood, and a pawn shop there. That Ford garage that used to be right there, they didn't even try to come back after the flood.
That's a lot of buildings right there.
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Harold Worley and his wife Gloria live in a white single-story house that sits some 20 feet above the Guyandotte River.
Right down there where that red car is at, back this side, that driveway, just pull in there. Yep.
When we stand on their back deck, the Guyandotte is a gentle, bubbling creek just a few inches deep. But on that Sunday 4 years ago, the water rose fast, jumped that 20 feet up to the bank, and then kept on rising.
When it come over the bank here, it wasn't 15 minutes till it was up in the house.
Another 4 feet or so.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. When it come down right over on Mr. Weaver's porch over there, we was hanging on a boat with our arms around that post on his porch over there, and that's where we hung on to right there.
We was in the house.
Yeah.
I was on the table with my feet in a chair, and the water still come up to there on me.
Up to your chest.
Come up, yeah.
And it was so swift. What we was doing was hanging on that post in case we had to get them out and put them on the roof of the house.
That sounds like just a really terrifying morning.
Oh, it was a terrifying morning.
I don't think it sunk in with me. We sat over and sung.
What were you singing?
Row, row, row.
The Worleys had flood insurance. They got $60,000 from that, added in some $40,000 of their own, and completely rebuilt their house. They figure the flooding was as bad as it was because of strip mining and timbering on these mountains. And you'll hear a lot of people complain about that. Several mass litigation lawsuits are heading to trial. People suing the mining and timbering companies for damages they sustained in the 2001 flood. The companies maintain the floods were simply a matter of too much rainfall in too short a time, that their operations didn't play a part. But the Worleys see environmental damage from industry all around them.
If you go back toward Beckley, you can see along the road where they've clear-cut it, and what they call the clear-cut, and they cut everything. Mm. And now you ain't got nothing but the mountain, and you don't have nothing to hold that water. Of course, then when you get a heavy rain, like what I was talking about, that was out of the ordinary, and you get both of them together, and you got something.
And you think it made it worse?
Oh, it made it worse. There's no doubt about it.
We never had floods like this before. Up on Mullins Hill, there's no river, no nothing. And it's about washed that place, some of it out. So what does that tell you? It's coming off these mountains. It really is. And I think they need to do something. I don't know what. We're going to wash this all away.
See, we've tried to get the federal government and them to come in here and dredge these creeks, but they don't want to talk about that anymore. You know, they just don't want to hear.
They don't want to disrupt the river.
They don't want to interrupt the crawdads and all that in there.
Harold Worley is the official mayor of Mullins. You might call Butch McNeely the unofficial mayor, or maybe goodwill ambassador.
Chester! Doing good.
He knows everybody.
Hey, bud. I was telling him about you.
And a quick stroll through town is an endless opportunity for socializing.
Lou.
What's up, buddy? You all dressed up, aren't you?
Butch McNeely is the State Farm Insurance Agent in Mullins. When the floods came through, he was on the city council. Now he works with the Watershed Committee and the Rural Appalachian Improvement League, thinking about ways to help the rivers and help the town. Right after the flood, some people thought, why not a flood wall to run along the Slab Fork through Mullins?
We would have liked to have had one. This city, if you look at this city, it starts right here, the main part of the city, and ends right over there. Most malls are twice as big as what our city is. You could put a roof and a dome this place. You know, a little flood wall would stop everything, a 5-foot flood wall.
And what happened with that?
We don't know. It just never happened.
Since the floods, they have opened up a community center in Mullins inside an abandoned grade school. The school was built in the 50s, abandoned in the 90s, after it flooded too many times.
We'll do y'all's and then we'll do Boots, Coot, and Boogie. Y'all remember it?
There's line dancing on Tuesday nights, 7 people on this night, in an old yellow brick classroom with a sink in the corner. Down the hall from the line dancing, a small group is meeting to come up with a strategic plan for Mullins, how to revitalize downtown, fix up the parks, and how to prepare for more floods.
Stream fill-up is part of our problem.
Many would like to see dredging of the Guyandot River to make the channels wider and deeper so they can handle more water. Kelly Jo Dre, a Vista volunteer in Mullins, has brought some bad news on that.
No dredging.
Well, even if it's just returning it to its pre-flood condition.
Yeah, no.
There's been a lot of confusion about that.
Now, dredging is done all the time in other rivers. Why can't it be done in the Guyandot? The Mississippi, the Ohio, all of them. How do they keep these barges going?
You're right.
You know, because they dredge them.
That's Frank Blackwell. He's superintendent of schools for Wyoming County. Tonight, he also has some bad news. The town has been asking the Army Corps of Engineers to carry out a reconnaissance study of the Guyandot to figure out ways to prevent future floods. The study would cost about $100,000.
We did find out we did not get funded for our flood study.
When did they make their decision on that? Pre or post Katrina?
Well, it was just recently, in the last few months, that they did not fund it, but I really think that we just did not have the right public servant working on it.
Frank Blackwell says this group has been meeting for about a year now, motivated by what happened in 2001.
I think what happened, the flood woke everybody up around here. I think we just got used to losing population and losing jobs, watching our area go down, losing coal mines. So I just think people just kind of got in a rut around here. And then when that flood hit, I think that was just the blow that woke everybody up. And everybody says, hey, you know, we've got to do something.
Is it a frustrating thing for you here, thinking the river is much the same as it was 4 years ago, and we get a really dramatic rainstorm again, and this town could be flooded again, just like it was before?
That's my number one worry, because all of the good, great things that have happened here since the flood of 2001, can be destroyed almost in an instant. So much work and time has been put back into rebuilding this town, for example, and rebuilding other communities in the Upper Guyandotte. And, you know, I just hope to the good Lord above that, you know, we can get enough done before another 2001 reappears.
When the rains come now in southern West Virginia, people get jittery. They're nervous as they watch the rivers, wondering how high they'll rise, how much time they'll have to get out, if they have to.
That was NPR's Melissa Block reporting on All Things Considered back in 2005. She was in Mullins, West Virginia, revisiting the events of the 2001 flood. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from people who lost their homes and some who decided to move because of the floods of 2001. McDowell County resident Alan Cathead Johnston wrote this song about the flood. Here he is singing Muddy Water with Stacy Grubb, his daughter.
Muddy water, can you hear me? Can't you see what you have done? Can't you see that you're not welcome here today? We worked hard all our lifetimes for what little bit we had, just to have you come and take it all away. Muddy water came and washed it all away.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're talking about life after a flood. What are the lessons and what does it take to rebuild? Is it simpler just to move away? After the recent floods in West Virginia, some people have already begun to prepare to pick up and move to another part of the state, or even out of state after their home was destroyed. But many of the folks we've spoken to say they're going to stick it out and try to rebuild within their communities, because home is home. Back in 2005, people along the Gulf Coast were coping with the damage from Hurricane Katrina. In the wake of that disaster, NPR's Melissa Block came to my old stomping grounds in Wyoming County to see what these communities could reveal about the long-term effects of a natural disaster and whether people can rebuild. Let's pick it back up with her story, which originally aired 11 years ago.
I take a drive through the hollows of Wyoming County along a creek called Milam Fork. It's raining. Plumes of smoke from wood stoves lift above small, weather-beaten homes and trailers up on cinder blocks, the ones that are left.
See, that's a FEMA trailer. The one sitting on the hill is a FEMA trailer.
My guide is Greg Fortner, who's lived here all his life.
There used to be another house sitting right here, and it got flooded, and it's gone.
The floods on July 8, 2001, turned the tiny Milam Fork into a monster. The only death in the flood was here, in the town of McGraws. Bonnie Shoemate, 58 years old, washed out of her house.
We were standing on the railroad tracks right here. And her house hit that pine tree right down there. And it was like flushing a toilet. When it hit that pine tree, it busted the bottom of her house out and it just flushed her down and took her down about 50 yards. I'll show you where the fence line used to be where we found her.
Greg Fortner's house was up high and okay, but his cousin Teresa Smith lived in a house right by the creek. It's gone now.
In about an hour's time, he just wiped it out.
And where were you before?
Right there.
Nothing there now.
Just some trees.
Teresa Smith, her husband, and their two daughters live in a FEMA trailer now, overlooking the creek. The trailer was $1,000. She paid $100. A church out of Charleston covered the rest. She also got about $14,000 from FEMA. She used that to pay for clearing the land, putting in a septic system, water, and gas lines. The new trailer is just above where her house used to be.
I've lived in Wyoming County, around in this area, all my life. 42 years. I lived there 20-some in the house. And my dad built it. That was one reason I didn't want to leave it. I didn't want it condemned, but they had to. And my church was walking distance. I didn't want to leave it. We just didn't want to leave.
This is small town USA right here in small county USA. We don't even have a red light in this county. We don't have a four-lane highway. We don't have a hospital. But we've got some people that love their county and love their area and would do anything to help their fellow man and their neighbor.
Dean Meadows is Wyoming County's Director of Emergency Services. And this year's hurricanes along the Gulf Coast reminded him a lot of what his county went through in 2001.
I thought about the people that were in my job and what they were facing, the helplessness why all is going on, the devastation when it's over, and when you have to face the people and the things that you have to tell them. And they want to hear that you're going to help them and everything's going to be okay. You always can't give them that assurance. We went through months here thinking, is anything ever going to get normal again?
Dean Meadows works with FEMA on a program called Hazard Mitigation. For houses that have been destroyed or repeatedly flooded, FEMA might buy the homeowners out. If the home wasn't washed away, it'll be demolished. The land can't be built on again. A park could go in, or a garden or playground, but no pavement, no walled structures. More than 4 years after the flood, Dean Meadows is still mitigating people. And for some, the FEMA mitigation money becomes a ticket out of Wyoming County to someplace bigger with more opportunities. Dean Meadows worries about that.
You know, I've never refused anybody that wanted to apply for a hazard mitigation project, but I have talked to a few and said, you sure you want to do this and make this decision?
And why is that? Why?
Well, because I know they've always lived in Wyoming County. They've lived where they're at. I know what kind of effect it's going to have on us as a county when so many people leave. And I know we're losing good citizens. We're losing good people. My counterpart in Raleigh County, the next county over, jokes with me and says, I'm getting some more of your people, Dean. They're moving over to see me. I said, yep, I know that.
Let's see if those potatoes are done.
Joyce McKendry fusses over some homemade potato soup on her stove.
Buddy, did you salt and pepper this?
I just barely put a little bit of salt in it.
Joyce and Bud McKendry have spent 35 years in their cozy house on the Guyandot River. Listen to them talk about how they first met. She was 13, he was 19. They waited 6 years before they married.
He met me standing on the highway and he went by.
Over top of a fence, long blonde hair. I knocked her out.
Yeah.
I've had her for 50 years.
December the 24th, we'll be married 50 years.
The McKendrys figured they'd live in this house the rest of their lives, but they've been flooded too many times. They're being mitigated, which is to say FEMA has bought out their house. It'll be torn down. The McKendrys will be moving into a mobile home, and soon. The rooms are piled with boxes, neatly labeled. Angels for Xmas tree, mauve placemats. Their house has been flooded 11 times in 18 years, and it's been getting worse.
We cleaned mud out, honey, and I tell you, there was coal sludge in our basement and in our yard.
Yeah.
We was just tired. Tired of doing
that. When you do a job 11 times, I think it'll soak in on you to move.
When you think about moving from a home into a mobile home, will that be different? How will that be?
Well, it looks like a home.
It'll be cleaner, it'll be new, and I'm where there won't be nothing but water in the faucet, in the kitchen, in the bathtub, and a water hose. And I ain't gonna have to use that pump out there. And I'm gonna be tickled to death. When I'm gone, she'll have something to lay down, she won't drown. By golly.
I think I'll be happy. I can't quite imagine that I'm gonna move. You know what I mean? I can't believe that up there is my home, gonna be my home for the rest of my life.
That up there is the new double-wide mobile home Joyce and Bud will be moving into a few miles up the road.
We'll go right down through there.
Bud McKendry hunches through a cold rain. He's 75 now and has black lung disease after 33 years working in the coal mines. He's proud of his new home.
It's a humdinger from looking inside of it.
But to me, it's a sad sight. The two halves of the structure yawn apart in a V. Bud is impatient for the workers to come and bolt the sides together. Meantime, the insulation's getting wet. The vinyl siding is torn and flaps in the wind. The foundation is a watery mess.
I think they're going to have to put scuba gear on to get in there on top of that concrete.
Bud and Joyce McKendry will make this their home, a small, bare lot next to some mini storage sheds and directly behind the railroad track.
And how do you feel about the train?
Ma'am?
The train?
Oh, I have to get used to that sucker. I want that room right there. But when he blows that horn for that trestle up here, it'll jerk you out of that bed. Oh, that's a keen whistle on that train. Yeah, but I'll get used to it. Yeah.
Bud and Joyce McKendry put a brave face on the way their lives have been upended. Like many in Wyoming County, West Virginia, they're measuring not just what they lost, but how much they still have. For all the people who saw the flood as a reason to get out of the county, there are many, like Teresa Smith and the McKendrys, who found a different message. Stay. This is home.
That was Melissa Block reporting on the 2001 floods in West Virginia 15 years ago. The latest census data says there are now about 23,000 people living in Wyoming County. There are 2,000 people now living in Mullins. As we heard in Melissa Block's stories, some businesses have returned, and I visited Mullins in late June to find out what worked well for that community. I noticed that there weren't as many people walking around town as there used to be. Some of the buildings were gone, and others were starting to show wear. But I also noticed new murals, familiar faces, and renovated storefronts. I caught up with business owner Charlie Feller, who we heard from in Melissa Block's story, to find out more about what worked and what didn't for Mullins.
Money was provided by the state, and the program was administered by the Wyoming County Economic Development Authority, where each business got a $15,000 forgivable loan, the stipulation being they had to remain in business for 5 years before the loan became totally forgivable.
Charlie also says in Mullins it helped that after the flood, businesses worked closely together to rebuild, not in competition.
In the business sector, we all seem to want to pull together for one another, help with whatever we could help with, providing supplies to our neighbor, tipping them off about loan programs or different things like that, because the more businesses that did come back, then the better off the entire community would be.
The flood back in 2001 was considered a 100-year flood, and it also wiped out parts of neighboring McDowell County in West Virginia. And then, the following year, the 100-year flood hit McDowell County again. Markella Jeanette remembers those floods. She owns a business in Kimball, West Virginia, but she actually chose to expand her business after the floods. In a documentary called Hollow, here's Markella talking about why she chose not to leave home.
My name is Markella Jeanette, and I'm from Kimball, West Virginia. My family's been here since 1945, and as soon as this business became available, my dad and my grandfather went into a joint partnership, and we kept it going as a grocery store. My dad started having failing health with Alzheimer's, and so I took it over in 1980, and we continued to run it as a grocery store. In 2001, with the major floods that hit McDowell County, we had a major change.
Everything.
And I had always wanted to make a restaurant. I wouldn't do it because I felt like this was my dad's place and it was what he loved to do. Then after those floods, the good Lord had made the decision that I couldn't make, and it was now time for me to put my restaurant in and make that decision, and so that's exactly what I did. I reopened it as Yasu Deli February 7th of 2003. It's from a Greek phrase that means to your health or good morning or good day. I wanted to make a place that people could feel like they could come to and feel at home. And I feel like maybe I've done that. With my dad's story of poverty and hunger is one of the reasons I'm here. And if anybody stops by here and I think they need something to eat, they're going to get it. It makes me feel very good for people to come here and enjoy fellowship. That's another thing, the fellowship that we have here with the town people, and that's one of the things that you don't find a lot of places. That's one of the things that keeps me here. And you don't get that just anywhere. The love you feel from these people is so special. And you can move and you can make friends. I can make friends fairly quickly, but I can't make old friends.
That was Markella Jeanette, the owner of Yasu Deli in Kimball. That interview was part of a documentary called Hollow, produced by Elaine McMillian in 2012. Many people like Markella want to stay and help rebuild their communities, but flooding takes its toll on people, emotionally, mentally, financially, and it's difficult. But how do we better prepare for intense floods that could happen in the future? It can also be really difficult for small towns to rebuild their infrastructure after a flood, especially if those towns are already hurting financially. What causes these floods in West Virginia? It might seem like a silly question, and you're probably thinking, well, too much water. But here in the coal fields, it's not always that simple. Back in 2002, Living on Earth reported about these two major floods that ravaged communities in McDowell, Wyoming, and other parts of southern West Virginia. Let's listen to a report from Jeff Young that looked into what made these floods so bad.
The flash floods of May 2nd damaged or destroyed a third of the homes in the town of Colwood. It's the second major flood in 10 months. Colwood residents wonder if their town's two namesake industries are responsible.
I was born and raised right here in this camp. I've never seen nothing like this. This is unreal.
Rollins Tabor's home was surrounded by water after a landslide diverted a stream into his street. The slide is just below a steep, treeless logging site.
They've logged it and logged it and logged it and logged it and just literally destroyed it. I mean, that's why all the water comes in here on us.
Logging in McDowell County is up by one-third in recent years. Land logged in the last 3 years covers some 6% of the county.
They need to get some help in here, don't they?
In nearby Turnhole Branch, even some homes far uphill from the swollen Tug Fork River did not escape damage. Large, jagged rocks, some the size of bowling balls, came tumbling down with water from the top of the hill. Lorenzo Thomas stands among the rocky debris that now paves his neighborhood.
Yeah, it's a whole lot, but it's too much. It shouldn't have happened. They did something wrong up there. All this shouldn't have come down here with that water. It came from a strip job up on the mountain back at the end of the hollow.
The strip mine above Thomas's house is one of hundreds of abandoned surface mines in the state, places where bankrupt coal companies walked away from the damage caused by years of bulldozing and blasting. At this site, waste rock from the cut hillsides was piled around the mine, but the heavy rains sent tons of that rock hurtling onto the homes in the hollow below. An analysis of state mining records by the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition shows old and active strip mines covering more than 18,000 acres of McDowell County. Mountaintop removal mines also bury hundreds of miles of streams in the state's southern counties as companies blast the tops from hills and dispose of the waste rock and dirt in massive valley fills. West Virginia University geology professor Steve Kite says mining is making unprecedented changes to the land.
This southern West Virginia landscape is being transformed by the coal mining. And the amount of earthy materials being moved around in southern West Virginia is higher than any place in the lower 48 of the United States.
Residents suspect those changes in the landscape change the way water runs from the hills during rainstorms. They say trees that once absorbed and slowed runoff are gone, and erosion fills streams with silt, making flooding more likely and more severe. But scientists like Steve Kite say the issue is complex.
A lot of the damage from the July 2001 floods were related to these old mine spoil piles failing, adding sediment to the load of the streams, and then this sediment was used by the streams in scouring and eroding and making the situation worse. But in general, the well-done, well-completed mountaintop removal valley fill sites were not as big of a problem as the abandoned mines.
Industry representatives say there's no evidence linking mining and logging to flooding frequency or magnitude. Bill Rainey heads the West Virginia Coal Association.
Oftentimes in the mining process, you have benches. We have drainage structures. We're required by law to capture every bit of drainage that touches a mine site, so that mining actually impedes the runoff and slows the peak discharges. So we feel like it certainly has, in some cases, a beneficial effect.
But trial lawyer Stuart Caldwell says the mines have a cumulative impact on the area. Caldwell represents flooded residents who have joined a lawsuit charging mining and timbering companies contributed to the flood damage.
The fact of the matter is, when there is a critical disturbance that can happen to hillsides that so affects the rate of delivery of water to the natural drains that flash flooding occurs, there's a right way to mine, there's a right way to log, and obviously in West Virginia we're doing it all wrong.
Caldwell says 1,500 people have joined the suit so far, and he expects more clients as people assess damage from the recent floods. Back in Colwood, the damage is enough to make longtime residents like Francis Weaver want to leave for good.
I've been here 17 years, and I've fought this water over and over and over. And this time, it's worse than it's ever been, and it really got me this time, and I just don't have the heart to try to fight it anymore. You fight so much, you run out of fight.
Might not be much comfort to Weaver, but about a dozen federal and state agencies are studying the possible links between mining, timbering, and the area's flooding. Federal agencies are at work on a long-delayed, comprehensive environmental assessment of mountaintop removal mining. Virginia and West Virginia plan to complete studies this summer that could provide some answers to the months of muddy misery. For Living on Earth, I'm Jeff Young in Colwood, West Virginia.
The lawsuit Jeff mentioned made its way to the state Supreme Court. There was a little bit of a struggle after a jury sided with residents, only to have the decision overturned by the judge and eventually upheld on appeal at the state Supreme Court. The case was dismissed in 2013 after both parties settled out of court. We don't know yet whether timbering or mining had any impact on the latest floods in West Virginia. But how do we better prepare for events like this in the future? Do we know better than to build and live in these regions? Well, after the flood of 2001, lawmakers pushed to have a state flood plan completed by the State Conservation Agency. Of course, no amount of planning can completely prevent the deaths and destruction from last month's flood. But a recent report in the Charleston Gazette-Mail found that West Virginia does have a plan, more than a decade in the making, designed to save lives and prevent major flood damage. But that plan is mostly gathering dust on a shelf. This report was discussed on last week's episode of the Front Porch Podcast. Laurie Lynn and Scott Finn spoke with the Charleston Gazette-Mail reporter Ken Ward about the one state worker who tried in vain to get this flood plan implemented.
They literally had dozens and dozens of recommendations. They ranged from kind of sexy things that got them more attention at the time, such as better regulating timbering or better regulating strip mining, to really kind of boring, almost incomprehensible things about floodplain management and flood insurance, to things like having better standards for stream crossings and culverts, to a really important thing, flood warnings. In the 85 flood, there really wasn't much of a warning system. You would think today with social media that there's, you know, just constant weather warnings. But then again, in West Virginia is a very old state. A lot of older people up hollows don't necessarily pay attention to social media constantly. So are they being warned appropriately? And that was one of the key recommendations, was improving those sorts of things.
So would it help to have a guy, a flood guy, whose job it would be to oversee all this, and then it would kind of be on his or her head if we weren't prepared?
One of the people I interviewed for this story, a guy named Russ Campbell, who was the co-author of this report, who's a retired employee now. When I talked to him, I'd been trying to reach him for several days, and I couldn't reach him because he has family in Elkview. And he was out all day, and when I finally got a hold of him, he said that that was really one of the things that we're trying to do. An interesting thing about this, you know, you see guys, you know, 26 government agencies, a 365-page report, this just sounds like typical bureaucratic nonsense. And if you look at this report, something like 40 pages of it were a list, was a list of the agencies that had some role and what their role was. One of the things they were trying to do was bring all of these different people together so they at least knew each other's names. One of the things we learned from the water crisis here in the Kanawha Valley was that you had Bureau for Public Health over here and DEP over here and the state over here and OSHA over here, and they often didn't talk to each other very well, or, you know, they just knew the abbreviation of some other agency, well, that's such and such, but they didn't know the person there. And one of the things this group was trying to do was improve on that so they all worked together better. But certainly, you know, Russ Campbell and the other people involved with this felt there needed to be some sort of overarching role for someone who it is whose job it was to work on these things.
Do you think it matters to the actual flood victims that we as a state didn't get this thing implemented fully?
Certainly the folks that worked on this, you know, Russ Campbell was a lifetime government employee. He was a forester who fought forest fires. He worked for DNR as a mine inspector. He was one of the first class of federal mine inspectors in 1978 after the Surface Mining Act passed. And then he spent many years of his career working on this particular project. I know that after talking to him, after he had been up helping people clean up from this flood, he thought that, you know, why didn't we do something with this?
I was going to ask you about that. It's from the words he used in your article, it sounds like he was sad and regretful. Is that
in trying to track him down, I had several long conversations with his wife when she would answer the phone and be apologizing that he wasn't there. And she kept telling me, oh, he's going to want to talk to you. He's been talking about this over and over again. And this is a huge regret of his. He retired about 2-3 years ago. And one of the problems, I think, sometimes for people in government is when they're afraid that something bad is going to happen, they're also scared to death that if they try to do something about it, they're going to just be targeted. And these aren't some alien beings that are out there, you know, trying to make all of our lives hard. There are neighbors that are trying to do work for us. And it would probably make it easier for us, for them, to help our communities if they didn't have to be so afraid of being demonized when they try to do something. If they say, hey, you know, maybe we need to do a little bit more to prevent runoff from timbering operations, if they felt like they could say that out loud without it turning into some giant thing where they were jackbooted thugs.
That's reporter Ken Ward speaking with Scott Finn. You can find Ward's story in the Sunday Gazette Mail and hear more of this interview on the Front Porch podcast, available on NPR One, iTunes, SoundCloud, or our website, wvpublic.org. Coming up, could this flood plan be more critical now than ever? Climate scientists say flash flooding will become more dangerous and more common. We'll discuss that and more in the final part of our show. I'm Jessica Lilly. This is Inside Appalachia.
The rivers are swollen, we got a flood on our hands. Get out the buckets and the pots and the pans. Mama put the pictures in the old wooden boat. Billy get the baby in Mama's overcoat. There's high grounded green by the old grist mill store. We can keep everybody dry if it don't rain. We got a flood on our hands. The rain's gonna keep coming down.
Thanks for listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Since the recent June 23rd flood, 12 counties have been declared federal disasters. The Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management says about 1,500 homes were destroyed and an additional 4,000 homes suffered damage. They also say about 125 businesses have been destroyed. The West Virginia Department of Transportation says initial road damage estimates across the state total more than $36 million. Of that, more than $24 million is expected to come from FEMA and the rest from the Federal Highways Administration. So, did climate change play a role in this flood? Glynis Board spoke with several experts and has this report.
Lots of people who grew up and live in southern West Virginia swear flooding has never been as bad as it is today. Of course, not everyone agrees why. It's likely a combination of forces at work. But how much of a role is climate change playing? Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University and the director of a Center for Climate Research.
Data are very clear. There is a substantial increase in what we call the intensity of rainfall events, which is simply to say flooding, more extreme and more prevalent flooding.
Despite that data, some scientists say it's actually really hard to prove unequivocally on paper that climate change is creating more flooding or changing the nature of floods in West Virginia. Steve Kite is a geologist and a researcher at West Virginia University who specializes in earth surface processes, including things like floods and landslides.
There are a number of papers out which have tried to prove it based on flood histories. And to this point, they have not really been able to say that that is the case.
So let's just unpack this climate change issue a little bit. Climatologists like Mann explain that as the globe has warmed 1 degree Celsius, the amount of moisture in the atmosphere has increased by about 5%. Mann compares the atmosphere to a sponge.
The warmer the atmosphere is, the more water there is in that sponge. And when you squeeze it, you're going to get more intense rainfall events, more intense flooding. And the data indeed indicate that that is happening in the U.S.
One thing that we do know for sure, West Virginia is naturally prone to flooding. In fact, it's one of the most flash flood-prone states in the country, and maybe even the world. A lot of that has to do with the rugged Appalachian Mountains. We've got these stacked ridgelines and deep hollows that are really good at shaking moisture out of storms and channeling it quickly downstream to larger rivers. Data from NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, indicate that while some places like California are experiencing extreme drought, the amount of water in extreme rainfall events has increased 70% in our region over the course of the last century. So climate scientists like Mann are not totally surprised by West Virginia's once-in-a-millennia 2016 flood. Meteorologist Sean Sublett from the nonprofit organization Climate Central in New Jersey says it's a safe assumption that climate change played an impactful role.
Climate change certainly raises your odds. It raises the stakes. Right now, I think the National Weather Service suggests that this kind of rain that happened in West Virginia was a 1-in-1,000-year event. As we go forward in time in the coming decades, that frequency would probably increase.
Right. So imagine an athlete on steroids. If he hits a home run, say, no one can directly attribute that particular success to drug use. But the chances of that athlete hitting home runs are greatly increased by steroids. So in West Virginia, the flood was the home run. Climate change is the drug. And many scientists agree that there may be a cocktail of drugs in West Virginia's case if you also consider land use issues like timbering and mining practices, as well as floodplain management. Climate scientists say the bottom line, in the coming decades, floods are going to happen, and likely more often and more intensely. And regardless of the cause, geologists and climatologists agree. West Virginians can be and need to be thoughtful and careful about how we rebuild in the wake of recent flooding.
We're Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
On today's show, we've talked about life after a flood and tried to figure out what it takes to rebuild mentally and physically. It's not easy. And this flood came at a time when many West Virginia families are struggling because of the state's poor economy and when the mining industry is at a crossroads. Things change. Even in biblical times for Noah, the flood represented a new beginning. And perhaps this will be part of the new opportunity to reinvent ourselves in this region. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from NPR's All Things Considered. Music in today's show was provided by Joe Ely as heard on Mountain Stage, Stacy Grubb and Alan Cathead Johnston, and Michael Howard. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.